From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Only once did Dan Rather's family ask him not to go on a reporting assignment. He was getting ready to leave for Afghanistan. This was in 1980, just after the Soviet invasion there. And his wife and daughter said they were worried. Rather says he explained to them that in some way he had to go, that being a reporter was what he did. And he did go. And it reflects one of the themes in his life, being willing to take a risk to get a story. Dan Rather was in Utah this week, which gave us a chance to talk to him in front of an audience about risk, regret, about loyalty, and about his reflections on journalism past and future. Dan Rather today, after the news. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Our latest evening of live radio drama is coming up on October 15th. We've partnered with Plan B Theater Company again for Radio Hour Episode 9, Grimm. Grimm as in the Brothers Grimm. We've got three fairy tales performed live on stage. Remember, the Brothers Grimm told really dark stories, so these are perfect for the Halloween season. You can listen live October 15th at 7, or you can join us as part of the audience. Go to radiowest.kuer.org for the details. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Veteran television journalist Dan Rather was in town this week, here for the annual gathering of the Economic Development Corporation, which gave us the chance to talk to him in front of an audience at the Grand America Hotel. This was on Tuesday. You can imagine being in a vocation that puts you at the front line of some of history's most important moments would give you lots of stories to tell, and Rather had lots of them for us. But they were all built around the themes in his life: risk, loyalty, and always this tenacity to get the really big story. Dan Rather was born in Wharton, Texas in 1931. It's been described as an oil patch town near the east coast of the state. His father did labor for an oil company. The family moved to Houston when he was still growing up, and when he turned 10, Dan Rather was struck with rheumatic fever. That's where we began our conversation.
When I contracted rheumatic fever, there was no known cure, and my mother had the kind of reaction you would expect a mother to have when the good Dr. Lewis Cope told her that I had rheumatic fever. It was every parent's nightmare, second only to polio, because there was no known cure for it. There is a known cure today, but there wasn't at that time. And the only advice the doctor had was put him to bed and have him move as little as possible, right, because rheumatic fever typically eventually reaches the heart and leaves one with an impaired heart. I had this for the better part of 3.5, going on 4 years.
Wow.
But it was the making of me, for better or for worse, and I know those who want to argue it either way, but making of me in that I had a lot of time to think. That's number one. And one of the things I thought about was how precious every day was, and you know how precious every hour was. The other was, had happened to me, I was wedded to the radio, and my contracting rheumatic fever corresponded almost with the start of World War II. So my constant companion day and night was radio correspondents who took me to faraway places with strange-sounding names and described the Great War. When I reached a point where the doctor felt it was all right for me to get up, I had not been going to school very often, and my father made a critical decision, one which my mother was not certain of at the time. I was emaciated. I was very weak, having been in bed all this time. And my father said, we have to put him to physical labor because if there's any chance he regains his strength, he'll get it that way. So at age 14, I went to work with a brush clearing crew. We were clearing brush with a survey of a pipeline in Texas, where I worked among grown men. Nobody's going to carry you. It could have gone either way, but it turned out I gradually got my strength back and went back to school and eventually managed to play football in high school and some in college. So it had a good ending to it. But a long-winded way of saying it certainly was a decisive time in my life.
You know, you've talked about the fact that your parents always read the newspaper. Your father, I think you put it this way, you said your father devoured
the newspaper.
Well, that is true. And when people ask me, when did I know I wanted to be a journalist? It was well before I got rheumatic fever, but I thought in terms of being a print journalist. And it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do, be a reporter. I know not why that is true, but my guess is because my parents, unlike a lot of people at their time and place, neither of whom had graduated from high school, both of whom worked with their back in their hands, but they devoured newspapers. My father saw a newspaper. In fact, he called newspapers the poor man's university. And he and my mother and my uncle would discuss things that were in the paper. So I think at a very early age, I began to think there must be, the paper, the newspaper must be important. Otherwise, my parents wouldn't spend all this time. And from that was born my desire to be a reporter.
He used to cancel subscriptions all the time, out of anger, I guess.
Well, yes, that's true. That my father didn't like editorials. He liked straight news. And he would read the editorials in the Houston Chronicle. We had three daily newspapers in Houston where I grew up. And he would literally rise from his chair and throw the paper against the wall and say, Burl, that's my mother's name, cancel our subscription for the Houston Chronicle. I'm finished with it. Well, it didn't take long. We were finished with every newspaper in town.
Right.
And to my real and certain knowledge, for a long while, we were the only house in Houston that got the newspaper almost a week late with the Christian Science Monitor, because it was the only paper that my father would allow us to continue subscribing to.
Right. Reading about your father, I really came to like the man, and certainly a lot of the stories that you tell about him. Rags was his nickname. And there seems to be a theme in some of the stories of your father's life to some themes in your own life. One that comes up from time to time in your story is this idea of loyalty. Your father was a loyal man, you've said. He wouldn't get gas anyplace but the company gas station. And I had read this profile of you where you used to have this saying on the door to your office. I'm not sure if you still do. The words of the Spartans who died holding off the Persians. What is the story of loyalty for you? Because it seems to go way back.
Well, first of all, and I recognize this was a long time ago, it isn't true that Sam Houston was still writing when I was in Texas, but it has been a long time ago. But these were the Depression years, and a job was a precious thing. And my father was the only person in our neighborhood in what would now be called a transition neighborhood, otherwise known as a tough neighborhood in Houston. And he was the only person in a 16-block radius who had anything approaching a regular job. The job was absolutely precious to him. And he worked first for the Houston Pipeline Company, and then he worked for Humble Oil and Refining Company. That job was a very good job. Now we're in the 1940s. But that's where the loyalty came in. It is true that if my brother or I were ever caught stopping at anything other than an Humble station, which is now Exxon, there was a price to pay for that. As for the Spartans, that's a different thing. The quote is, at the pass where the Spartans stopped the Persians and saved Western civilization some 400 years before Christ, the inscribed on the pass is the Spartans who fought to the last man, is go tell the Spartans, thou who passest by, that here, obedient to their laws, we lie. In Texas, where we're very proud of the revolution that we fought for our independence, when I was in the third grade, we were taken to the San Jacinto Monument, which is the monument to the victory of the Texans during the Texas Revolution. And carved in the base in Texas limestone is an inscription said, Thermopylae had its messenger of death. The Alamo had none. So as a third grader, it made no sense to me. And I asked our third grade teacher, Miss Spencer, what does that mean? And she said, well, Danny, I'll teach you about the Spartans and the great Greeks. And so she taught me about the Spartans. And from that time on, somehow it spoke to my inner self. I can't explain that, but I've had that inscription on every office door that I've ever had. Go tell the Spartans, thou who passest by, here, obedient to their laws, we lie. It speaks to loyalty, and I once taught my people who who believed in loyalty, loyalty to themselves, loyalty to family, loyalty to God and country. And so I'm not always able to explain the Spartan quote, but it always speaks deeply to me.
There's a story you tell. This also harkens back a number of years ago. You were a young reporter, and you were a DJ, and you were a sportscaster. It seems like you did everything at this radio station. This was near Sam Houston State Teachers College in Huntsville, where you studied. And you got a tip, I guess. You had reported on a house fire in the African-American part of this town. But then you got another tip that suggested that this wasn't an accident, but wasn't, in fact, a case of arson. So you had a choice, Dan Rather, at this point, to whether to follow that tip or not. And I wanted you to tell that story, if you would, because you've talked about how this was important, about catching the bug of investigative journalism.
I was working at KSAM in Huntsville, Texas, which was not a college radio station. It's a commercial radio station. And I worked for the late Pastor Ted Lott, who was a Baptist minister. Texas was segregated. There was institutionalized racism. Texas was not Alabama or Mississippi, but make no mistake about it, that segregation ran deep. There was a fire at home of an African-American family. At the radio station, I had become acquainted with a number of people in the African-American community. One of them called me and said, "Dan, if you look into this fire, you will find it's not what it appears to be." At any rate, I did look into it and went to the funeral home director, who told me that the fire had been called an accidental fire, all deaths by fire. And he told me that there were bullets in the bodies. And from that, I followed up and started asking questions, which in Huntsville's town of 3,500 people were not popular questions. Now, I'm not the hero of this story. I didn't break this story. I did report pieces of it. It eventually, they called in the Texas Rangers, and it turned out to be the case of a white citizen who was in an illicit affair with an African-American woman, had decided to kill the woman and then killed her mother and a child and burned to cover the evidence. This taught me very early, one, that I loved investigating. I love finding out what happened, what really happened. But two, I also found that there's a price to pay. Because at the radio station, Pastor Lott, a good and decent man, told me, said, "Dan, you have to watch it. Too much truth can be a very dangerous thing here at this time." It was a good lesson because it proved true over the length and breadth of my time as an investigative reporter.
I've read you use the term peasant stubbornness.
It's very clear. I was not born to privilege or place. My father was a ditch digger primarily. So we did have a kind of stubbornness as a family and as individuals, and I came to see it as a kind of peasant stubbornness, which is to say, sometimes you don't know enough to know you ought to quit.
Right.
You just keep on keeping on. Just put one foot in front of the other, head down, tail up, keep going, and you'll be surprised what can happen.
What was the impact of the story that you covered? Of course, you became CBS's Southern Bureau Chief, I think it was, and of course, that's how you came to cover the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. Would you say that that story really propelled your career in some way? I mean, how do you reflect back on that? Such a tragic moment. You uncovered, you were the first to report that President Kennedy was, in fact, dead.
Well, the fact that I was in Dallas the day that President Kennedy was assassinated, and I was had been put in charge of CBS News coverage of the president's trip to Texas, and this cataclysmic story developed in Dallas, I've never thought of it as something that propelled one's career, quote-unquote. I tend not to think in those terms, but I can fully understand someone observing the outside saying, well, however it happened, you were in that place, I won't say the right place, but that place at that time, it called attention to whatever skills you had, and your career advanced from that. All of those are facts. But journalism, like a lot of other things, You frequently aren't, you aren't thinking of that when you're doing the story,
sure.
maybe in the story past. Particularly a story like the Kennedy assassination. I mean, you know, it was an emotional earthquake to me individually, as it was to almost everybody in the country. So you have those moments, and there are only a few short moments in which you're going to go one way or the other. You're either going to succumb to your emotions, understandably, as almost everybody else is doing, or you're going to get a grip on yourself and say, I'm a pro. I've trained myself all my life to do this kind of work, to report on these kind of moments. So you push your own emotions so deep down within yourself that they almost disappear. And you get what the tennis players call zoned. There's a zone for journalism. There's nothing counts but the story. You don't think about the consequences for the country. You don't think about your own emotions. What are the facts? Who did what to whom? What facts do we have? What are the principal questions? A week or 10 days later is when the emotional impact hits you. It's a delayed impact. And so it was with the Kennedy assassination.
Did part of that impact have to do with the fact that you were a Texan and this had happened in Texas?
Yes, but I suspect, which is all I can do, not as much as people might think, that I am a Texan, and proudly so. I was Texas born, Texas bred, and when I die, I will be Texas dead. And I'm fond of saying, because it's true, I'm not only from Texas, I am of Texas.
Yeah.
But I knew my history. President McKinley was assassinated in Buffalo, New York. President Lincoln was assassinated in Washington, D.C. I mean, many Texans took it rather personally. And there were a lot of accusations around the country, look, this could only happen in Texas. It's a, quote, gun culture. It's a, quote, right-wing citadel, all of those things. I didn't feel much of that at the time, but I had to feel some of it because I was pretty much enveloped with it. There were plenty of people in Dallas, per se, who felt, boy, this ruins Dallas' reputation for the rest of history. And Mrs. Kennedy, the late Jacqueline Kennedy, the First Lady, had she had a dim view of Texas and Texans and had not wanted the president to go there. And when that fact was publicized after the assassination fact, it didn't help how Texans felt about one another.
That's Dan Rather, of course, recorded live at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake City on Tuesday. Rather was the guest of the Economic Development Corporation, their annual gathering there. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Dan Rather, recorded earlier this week in front of an audience at the Grand America Hotel.
I wanted to ask about covering the Nixon White House. There's a great story in the book about your first meeting with H.R. Haldeman. This was in 1969, Nixon's very tough chief of staff. You want to tell the story about when you first met H.R. Haldeman?
Well, H.R. Haldeman was the person closest to President Nixon and had been during the campaign. I did not know President Nixon nor Haldeman well at all. I had met President Nixon and had covered him going back to 1960, but didn't know him well. I had been the White House correspondent for CBS News during most of the Johnson administration. I had had difficulty with President Johnson, as most reporters did at one time. Another, partly because President Johnson felt I was a Texan and I should kind of be on the team, so to speak, which I wasn't. When President Nixon got elected, frankly, I thought, well, this is a fresh new start for me. So I met with Mr. Haldeman, and to my surprise, he said right away, he said, we know who you are, and we know how to deal with you. And so I said to him, well, that's a surprise if you know who I am, because there are plenty of days when I don't know who I am. Who do you think I am? And he said, well, you know, you're a left-wing Texas liberal Lyndon Johnson Democrat, which, frankly, I could have been more surprised if he's accused me of being a Dalai Lama or something, because I'd had trouble with President Johnson. And I prided myself on being a reporter, independent-minded, yes, and fiercely independent when necessary. But I had a reputation for playing no favorites and pulling no punches. And I had rather hoped that was his view of me and their view of me. But it was not. But the record shows it wasn't just, I wasn't the only one, that President Nixon, unfortunately, came to the American presidency as well prepared as virtually any president we've ever had, with potential to be one of the great presidents in the country's history. Unfortunately, for reasons that are unknown to me and I think indecipherable, he was a hater. That is, that it wasn't good enough to beat his opponents. Within him, he wanted to destroy his opponents. And he felt that the press had been an instrument for his opponents, everybody in the press, with very few exceptions. So from that moment with H.R. Haldeman, yes, I had a very difficult time with the Nixon administration, as did most other reporters. But we're talking about a period, this was at the very start of the Nixon presidency. By the time we reached the second term for President Nixon, in which increasingly it became clear that the president had not only engaged in but had led a widespread criminal conspiracy. It still sort of causes a lump in my throat because you don't want to believe it, but that's what we call for shorthand Watergate was in fact a widespread criminal conspiracy led in part by the president himself from the Oval Office. As the facts of that became emerged, the hostility that President Nixon bore within himself, not just toward the press, but toward any and everyone he perceived not to agree with him, the consequences of that became increasingly evident.
You know, there's a story that, it's this surprisingly poignant story, actually, related to the Nixon White House, which may surprise someone. You were very aggressive about covering this story, of course. But in the last days of Watergate, you tell the story how when President Nixon's daughter, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, was going to give this speech in defense of her father, because you have a daughter, your daughter Robin, he said you remember feeling really emotional about this and saying, "Mr. President, don't let her do this."
Well, that story is true and was one of the most poignant moments that I can remember in covering the White House as chief White House correspondent for more than 10 years. The situation was, we're now in 1974. It's becoming evident that what the president had been saying about his role or lack of role in this widespread criminal conspiracy was untrue. The noose was tightening on his presidency. It wasn't a matter of conjecture. It wasn't a matter of rumor. It wasn't a matter of debate. There were facts. And at that time, the president was, this particular day, the president was in the Oval Office, maybe 25 or 30 yards just beyond the magnolia tree that Andrew Jackson planted, and right at the edge of the garden that Jacqueline Kennedy had planted, his youngest daughter came out and held a sort of impromptu news conference in which she fiercely defended her father, as any man would hope his daughter would want to do. And President Nixon was in the Oval Office, and I often think he must have been looking out the window. He knew what the facts were. She was out there giving this impassioned defense and saying, people understand my father. I will say, as a father, I didn't understand then, and I haven't understood a day since then, how he could possibly allow her to do that. And it was a scene I never forgot. In my mind, from time to time, there are these freeze frames of times at the White House. And when President Johnson, near the end of his presidency, when he knew he was finished, that the war, fairly or unfairly, rightly or wrongly, had ruined his presidency, that he stood at the window on the second floor, living quarters of the White House, and looked out across the lawn to the street where crowds had gathered with signs and shouting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" That Lyndon Johnson had been in politics all his life. He had a thick armor and a thick skin. But, you knew that nobody's armor was so thick at the point of those spears, metaphorical spears, weren't getting through to him. Standing up, he sort of stood the window overlooking that. Those are the moments that stick with you.
You know, I think some may be surprised, because you covered so many presidents and you were so aggressive in getting to the real story, you have this abiding reverence for the office of the presidency. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say and accurate to say. Look, I never walked through the gates of the White House a single day. Widely believed it may not be, but true it is. I never walked through the gates of the White House that I didn't feel a certain tinge, a certain tingle. I was very proud to be there, very proud to have the responsibility of being a White House correspondent and a chief White House correspondent. And, you know, I try not to take myself seriously, but I take my work seriously. And I saw it as a public trust, and I wanted to be responsible to that trust. To do that job, you have tremendous respect and reverence, yes, reverence, for the office of the presidency of the United States, because you understand that in our system of government, our president is both head of government and head of state. In Great Britain, the Queen is the head of state. The Prime Minister is the head of government. But in our system, the president is both in one and the same person and commander-in-chief. So the office demands tremendous respect. But it's the essence of being an American, the holder of the highest honor we can bestow on any human, to be president of the United States, is just another citizen. Thank heaven, we in this country, we don't believe our president is the descendant of a sun god or ruled by divine right. He is in that position at the will of the people. And therefore, as a correspondent, you always want to be respectful, even reverent, about the office. But the person, see him as another person who's been given a tremendous responsibility. And again, widely believed it may not be given my record, but I always tended to give presidents the benefit of the doubt, and still do, whether they're Republican or Democratic. It's one reason that I was somewhat late coming to the Watergate story. I didn't want to believe that any president would engage in these kinds of things, so I was kind of slow to come around to it.
There's another theme, anyway, that I've seemed to have detected in your career, and that is being willing to take risks, real risks, to gather news. In your book, you write about walking through the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan in 1980, just after the Soviet invasion, and you put it this way in the book. You said you had no idea just what you were getting yourself into. No U.S. military there, I guess. There were no representatives of the U.S. government there. I mean, there weren't any even, really, I don't think any other reporters were there at the time. This was a real risk, but you plowed forward.
Well, that's true, but I don't want to be overly dramatic about it. Look, if you're worthy of the name of a reporter, you want to go where the biggest stories are. And you don't report your instincts, but you follow your instincts.
Yeah.
And yes, I believed when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan at the very end of 1979 that it could be one of the defining events of the decade and perhaps of my generation. So the reporter in me said, go see, walk the ground. It is true it was going to be dangerous. But again, I want this to be seen in context because it could be taken the wrong way, that if you aspire to be a world-class correspondent, which means you're going to be a foreign correspondent, war zone correspondent, you want to do those things, then some days, in some ways, danger is my business. Not every day, in every way, but to try to walk into Afghanistan and try to walk out alive, yes, was dangerous. I think it's fair to say if I had known how dangerous it turned out to be, I can't say I wouldn't have gone, but I might have thought about it a little longer because I had with me a cameraman, a sound man, and a producer. I'm responsible for three other lives. It isn't just my own. But, you know, fortunately, we were able to walk in and walk out, and yes, it is one of the most dangerous things I've ever done.
But the part of the story that I found really interesting was the fact that your wife and your daughter, for the first time in your career, and maybe that was the only time they had ever done this, you had a big family conference. Your son was willing to say, okay, Dad, if this is what you want to do, but your wife and your daughter did not want you to go. And the way I've heard you tell this story, and this is what I find so striking about it, is you said something to the effect of, I have to go, and you said something like, this is my destiny?
Well, you know, young husbands say a lot of crazy and stupid things. And it is true. It was then and remains the only time that my wife and daughter, my daughter at the time this happened was probably 20 years old, and my son was 18 or 19. And we do have family councils, and particularly when the children were growing up, and we had a council about this. And it is true that my wife, Jean, said, I have a very bad feeling about this one. And my daughter, Robin, said the same thing. And Jean, my wife, said, I tell you, Dan, I think if you go, I don't think you're coming back. Now, that's pretty heavy stuff. And it is true that my son, Dan Jack, said, look, I wish you wouldn't go, and I think it's very dangerous, but I know you well enough, and if you want to go, to go. But I did say to Jean that I really feel strongly about going. I wouldn't go for just another story. I think this is a mighty story. And she made the argument she would expect. Well, listen, Dan, it's a story, but, you know, what about us?
Yeah.
But, you know, what about we three? That was a heavy session, to say the least. But it ended with Jean, my wife, and Robin, my daughter, saying, look, we understand. And since you feel that strongly about it, go with God, Godspeed, and for heaven's sakes, try to get back.
It seems like this is the only, you've admitted you have some regrets in your career, but this is one I think you've talked about fairly strongly. And I was thinking about, you actually laid this out for someone once, the time that you spent in the South, for example, covering the civil rights movement, the time you spent in Vietnam, practically a year. I guess that's the regret part, is that you were away from your family for that long. Is that right?
No, you know, I'd have to say, and I have to remind myself, I should have no regrets. But when you look back, the closest I would come to having regrets, professional regrets, are when the children were very young. My daughter was, just over 2, and my son was less than 1 when I first came to CBS News and was assigned to cover Dr. Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. We had no idea as a young family what I was getting into, what we were getting into. But the first year I was with CBS covering Dr. King and, you know, the South was exploding, the Civil Rights Movement was exploding. I was home 31 days the first year, and I was home 43 days the next year. I would submit to you, very few marriages can survive those kinds of being distant figures. And mostly thanks to my wife, Jean, with whom I've now been married 57 plus years, that it was, you know, it was always, look, things are going to get better, but they didn't get better. Vietnam, I was in Vietnam for almost a year. I did not intend to go for a year. But again, the story was, it was the greatest story of that time, one of the greatest stories of my generation. So what was supposed to be 3 months led to 4 months, led to 6 months, led to 8 months, led to 9 months. The point here is, by any reasonable analysis, I was not home as much as I should have been to be a totally responsible father and husband. And looking back on it, I say to myself, I wish it could have been otherwise, but I know within myself that when a story like the Civil Rights Movement, story like Vietnam, story like Afghanistan, when that story breaks, there's something in me, I'm going to go. I'm going to walk the ground.
For all those stories, though, it's interesting you said that the story that seemed to change you personally the most was 9/11?
9/11 and covering Dr. King are the two stories that I could say with certainty changed me as a person and changed me as a professional. One at or near the beginning of my career, covering Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement, remembering I was a child of segregation. And 9/11, never to be forgotten. You know, partly because I was of New York. I was a resident of New York. I lived in New York. This wasn't literally in my neighborhood, but in my city. But yes, it changed me as a person and changed me as a pro.
Dan Rather, recorded live at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake City on Tuesday. Rather was the guest of the Economic Development Corporation for their annual gathering. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting a conversation with Dan Rather, recorded earlier this week. We sat down with him in front of an audience at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake City. This was the annual gathering of the Utah Economic Development Corporation. Dan Rather was their guest of honor.
In your book, you write about the evolving nature of the news business. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this story that you covered where you, it seems like in some ways this is when you really started to notice that things were changing at CBS. And this was the Abu Ghraib story. This is April of 2004. You covered the story, of course, of the American military personnel. They were abusing and torturing Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. And you've said that this story was really the beginning of the trouble, ultimately, that led to your leaving CBS in 2006. But it's important to say, and I hadn't realized you broke that story, the Abu Ghraib story. But you had a hell of a fight to get it on the air, I guess.
Well, this is true, that in covering the Iraq War, what I call Gulf War II, Gulf War I being when Saddam Hussein first interviewed Kuwait. But I'd been in and out of Iraq between the start of the Iraq War, 2001, 2002, and 2004. I think I'd been to Iraq 16, 17 times. Yes, we discovered the abuses at Abu Ghraib, and we broke that story on a worldwide basis, print and broadcast. But there was a hell of a fight within CBS News about whether to put it on, and if so, in what form to put it on. CBS News was, and I think remains, but I haven't been there for almost 10 years. But when I was at CBS News, it was a national institution in that it was, yes, a commercial enterprise, but it was dedicated to the idea and the ideal that news was a public trust, and that the people who worked at CBS News, as well as the people in the corporate entity and the ownership of the company, were invested in the responsibilities of what we saw as a public trust. The network that stood up to Joseph McCarthy, the network that stood up to the tobacco interests, the network that led in coverage of the Vietnam War, raising questions of the difference between what we were told by the government and what was the facts on the ground in Vietnam. I could go on. Had a long tradition of speaking truth to power, taking the heat, and having the corporate superstructure, as well as the news division itself, back its reporters. That was our history. We were very proud of it. That was the tradition. It's the reason those of us who worked there, we believed CBS News was a kind of magical, mystical kingdom in which every reporter was a knight dedicated to truth and justice in the American way. Now, it may not have been true, but the fact that we believed it made us better for it. So against that background, we come to the Abu Ghraib story, a terrible story. Another story that when we first started it, I hoped, yes, I literally prayed the story wouldn't be true. It was such an awful story. But we found the story. We confirmed the story, complete with having the pictures. You don't often get the pictures. We had it. Now comes an internal debate as to what we do with it. Those of us who felt invested in the tradition and history of CBS News, said, there's no discussion about whether to run the story. That's what we do. But there was a counter-argument that said, well, this may not be in our best interest to do it. What do you mean, not in our best interest? It's not our best interest. This was the argument. Mm. And the story was delayed 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
But I should also mention, because this is a critical part of the story, you got a phone call at home from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yes, a good and decent man whom I respected and knew quite well, who basically asked us not to run it. And I told him truthfully, I said, well, that's not my decision. That'd be the decision for at least the president of the news division. But I will tell you, General, that I think not only should we run it, we got to run it. But we're fairly deep into this now. At any rate, they delayed the story for a very long time. And in fact, it wasn't until several of our sources in the story began to say, and they said to me, the others, Dan, what is CBS waiting on? And I didn't have an answer for that. They began to think we weren't going to run it. So they started talking to another investigative reporter. Now, the decision makers are caught. They're reluctant to run it, or to run it in the way we had it put together. On the other hand, if they don't run it, this other investigative reporter is going to expose that they held the story. So they ran the story. But I do think it was a precursor, if you will. It was a portent of what was to come later in the year. This was early in 2004. And then later in the year, we worked on the story of President Bush's military service, or lack of same, which led to a lot of, what shall I say, untoward consequences.
Right. Well, this is a story that involved documents that said President Bush hadn't lived up to his commitment to the Texas Air National Guard, of course, photocopied documents from a military source. Now, one source denied that he had ever faked that, that they weren't forgeries, but that he did say he had lied about how he obtained those documents. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in is the way, I mean, you still stand by the truth of that story.
Well, I do stand by the story because the story is factual. Look, it's been, 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago. It's well behind me. It's not one of these things that I think about every day.
Yeah.
But check the record. We reported a true story. It has not been denied by the president nor anyone close around him since, and we're talking about 9 years since the story. What was the story? The story was, one, that rightly or wrongly, for whatever reason, that President George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, had used influence to ensure that a very young President George W. Bush get in the Air National Guard as a way of ensuring he wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. That's a fact. Number two, after getting into the National Guard, and a so-called, quote, champagne unit of the National Guard where special privileges were the norm, and after learning to fly aircraft and doing reasonably well, then young George Bush disappeared. This is not open to question. This is a fact. He disappeared. Now, anybody's ever been in the military, in the U.S. military, you don't just disappear. There are rules and regulations. So he didn't meet his commitment. So that was the heart of the story. Nobody then and nobody since has denied that. Now, because there was a presidential campaign underway, understandably, President Bush and his supporters, they couldn't deny the facts. They didn't deny it. So what they did was attack the process. I think this is very important to understand.
Yeah.
They said, well, listen, the process by which they arrived at this, what they call truth, was flawed. And indeed, the process was flawed. But that, so anyone wants to hold us accountable for a flawed process, fair enough. But what is our job as reporters? Our job is to report the truth. The truth is, as I outlined it, there are other truths, but those are the central two truths. They were true then. They've been true ever since. That's the reason I stand by the story. To this day, nobody has proven that the documents were not what they reported to be. Fair enough if someone says, but then, that shouldn't be good enough. You have never proved beyond any doubt whatsoever, I would say that's true. But I get back to check it out, the truth of the story, which there was no joy in reporting it. There's misunderstanding. Somehow or another, we had it in for George W. Bush, not true, or we disliked or whatever. As a matter of fact, I liked his father and rather liked him as a person. But that's not an issue.
Yeah.
The facts are the facts. The fact is he got into this unit to avoid going to Vietnam. And after he was in it a while, he disappeared to places and for reasons unknown. For that, we paid a heavy price. But if I had it to do over again, I'd report the story. I'd like to think we'd do a better job on the documents.
See, it's interesting. But that process, the criticism of the process seems to be the lesson that you learned. One of the themes that you've talked a lot about now is this concern over the corporatization, the politicization, the trivialization of the media now. And so I just wondered if that taught you lessons about where things seemed to be or seemed to be headed.
Well, this is a criticism of American journalism I'm about to, but it's very important to me that you understand. I do not accept myself from this criticism. That in many important ways, American journalism, particularly electronic journalism, talking about television primarily, we need a spine transplant. We've lost our guts. We've lost our courage. We've lost the quintessential character of American journalism. But listen, I don't give a damn who's against it. I'm going to tell you what I know, and I'm going to get as much of the truth as I can, and you're going to find it out. We become hesitant. We pull back a little. There's a greater tendency now just get in the middle and move with the herd, because that way you don't take any risks. Being a Texan, you'll forgive me, I say it's like a flock of turkeys. You know, if two turkeys go over the cliff, the whole flock is going to go over the cliff. So it is with press now. This is a result, I maintain, in no small way, of the consolidation of media. As we said here this afternoon, no more than six, my count is four, but no more than six very large international conglomerates control more than 80% of the true national distribution of news. I would submit this in itself is unhealthy. Here's among the reasons it's unhealthy is because, and if you will, if you must, forgive my reporter's French, very big media is in bed with very big government. No matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats who at any given moment control the government, for their mutual benefit, not for the benefit of the audience. And what this has resulted in, we have far less deep-digging investigative reporting now. At the very moment when I would suggest to you we need more, we have the least we've had at least since sometime before World War II. The sense of news as a public service has been drained out of, particularly electronic news, I would suggest almost all news. It's easier to put five people in a room shouting at one another about what we should do in Afghanistan rather than have a bureau and report on the ground what's happening there. It's a whole lot easier, it's less riskier, and those who own the principal distribution points like it better because it doesn't cause them trouble. If you do a deep-digging investigative report on a power center in Washington, again, Republican or Democrat, the leaders of the corporate industry shudder because they are asking those same people in Washington for legislation they want passed, regulations they don't want passed. So this is the reason I say that we've lost our spine, we've lost our guts, and that's not good for the country. We know down where we live because we're taught that a free press, a truly independent press, a fiercely independent press when necessary, is the red beating heart of democracy and freedom. That has shrunk. And that's why I say it's a problem not just for those of us who are in the press. This is a societal problem. This is a national problem for us, and one that I think if we don't address, we will do that at our peril.
Do you feel optimistic that we will figure this out when the dust settles?
I'm an optimist by nature and by experience. I think it's a bad phase of the moon. It's a bad period. And partly because no one has yet figured out how to sustain financially things like expensive investigative reporting and foreign reporting. But, you know, this is America. And I have great faith in the people of the country. I have great faith in the country that we'll get this squared away. But the question for journalism, particularly those who own the instruments of distribution of journalism. Listen, yes, you want to answer the question of what's good for your company, what's good for your stockholders, what's good for your employees, but can't we some of the day say what's good for the country?
So these days, for those who don't know, you're hosting Dan Rather Presents. It's an investigative reporting series on Access TV. It's a cable channel. I know you like to fish. I know you have a cabin. You have a retreat in Texas, a place where I know you like to go to. So you'd be forgiven, Dan Rather. You've been doing this a long time for wanting to retire. You thinking about it at all?
I don't really think about it. You know, I love what I do. That I can be dumb as a concrete wall about a lot of things, but I'm at least smart enough to know how lucky and blessed I am to have been able to make a living to support my family and doing what I have a great passion for doing. For whatever reason, I love covering news. Retire to what? I'd much rather wear out than rust out. And as long as I have my health and as long as somebody will give me a platform to do it, I love covering news, and that's what I intend to do. You know, I think everybody who gets into journalism, it certainly would include me, gets in partly because you want to be part of something bigger than yourself. You ache to do something that matters. That if you believe, as I do, that, you know, the measure of a person's life is that person's service. Journalism, at its best, gives one a chance to be of service. And as long as I can be of service, I intend to go full throttle forward.
Dan Rather. He's written three memoirs, by the way. His latest is called Rather Outspoken, My Life in the News. These days, he hosts Dan Rather Presents. It's an investigative reporting series on Access TV. That's a cable channel available on Dish and DirecTV here in Utah. There are four new episodes airing in November. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, the President and CEO Jeff Edwards, and the Marketing Director Kimberly Frost in particular. Thanks also to Cornerstone Technologies. They recorded the conversation. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.